I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In 2017, Brandy Levy, a sophomore at Mahanoy Area School District in Pennsylvania, posted an expletive-filled diatribe on Snapchat about not making it on the varsity cheerleading team. Her angry message included holding up her middle finger with the caption, F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything. This was a Saturday, and she was off campus. Her coach found out about her post and suspended her from JV cheerleading for a year. Her family sued the district, claiming her First Amendment rights were violated, and the case made it through the lower courts to the U.S. Supreme Court, which heard arguments this spring. While an angry cheerleader with her F-bomb-filled rant may not seem like a critical constitutional issue, it is when it comes to the rights of students to express themselves and a school's rights to police potentially dangerous and disruptive off-campus and online speech. The court is expected to make its decision in the next few days, and according to reporters who covered the hearing, the justices struggled with the arguments in this case. We have two guests who will struggle with us. Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is right across the street from us here in Philadelphia. He's a professor of law at George Washington Law School and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back.
And also with us and joining us by Skype is Justin Driver. He's the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law at Yale Law School, author of a book titled The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. And Justin Driver, it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be with you, Marty.
In fact, Justin, let me begin with you. Why is this case so important?
This case is incredibly important indeed. It's the most anticipated student speech case in more than 50 years because so much of the speech that students offer is off campus but online. And school administrators and the lower courts have really struggled with this issue for at least a decade, hoping for some guidance from the Supreme Court of the United States. And the other reason that it's awfully important is that in the 1960s, the Supreme Court issued a decision called Tinker that afforded students some free speech rights. But that was the last moment that a high school student has won a free speech case. And so the stakes could not be higher, in my view.
Jeffrey, quoting from Nina Totenberg, who covered the arguments a couple of months ago, and it was so interesting, Justice Breyer saying, if swearing off campus did qualify, my goodness, every school in the country would be doing nothing but punishing. Sotomayor said, I'm told by my law clerks that among a certain large percentage of the population, how much you curse is a badge of honor, and on from there. Were the justices really struggling with this, with the arguments on both sides?
They certainly will. They certainly were. And it is a privilege to struggle with you and with Justin Driver. Justin's book, The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind is the best book about student free speech rights in school. And I really recommend it to all listeners. It's also great to talk about this case because it comes from the Third Circuit, right around the corner from HYY and the Constitution Center. Marty, and there's a really interesting division among the judges on the Third Circuit about how to approach free speech rights that the justices were grappling with. So first we had Judge Cheryl Ann Krause, who, joined by Judge Stefanos Bibas, basically said that the Tinker case, which Justin mentioned, shouldn't apply to off-campus speech, that is, speech that's outside school-owned, operated, or supervised channels, and that's reasonably interpreted as bearing the school's imprimatur. So that would be a really clear rule. We got bright line rule. You can talk on social media, and if it's off campus, then this Tinker case about substantial disruption doesn't apply. Then we had Judge Thomas Ambrose, who wanted to take a less categorical approach, and he said Tinker just doesn't apply in this case because there was no reason to think that the speech would cause substantial disruption. A cheerleader expressing frustration is not going to disrupt speech, and therefore you can keep the Tinker case intact, but it just doesn't apply here. And we saw the same division on the Supreme Court as the justices were struggling. Should we adopt that bright line rule? Should we adopt Judge Ambrose's approach? Or should we adopt the approach of the government that the question is, was the speech targeted at the school, and several of the justices, starting with Justice Alito and Justice Roberts, were wondering, what does it mean to have speech that's targeted on social media? So as Justin says, it couldn't be more fascinating and important, and maybe together we can solve it in the next hour.
Exactly. Before the court, which my understanding is that they have one more day and should be Thursday. So we will hear, hopefully, what they decide on this particular issue. Since you both mentioned the Tinker case, this goes back to 1969, U.S. Supreme Court decision, Tinker v. Des Moines, where students were allowed to wear armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War. Students, quoting here, do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. But it also said that you can't substantially disrupt school activities. Going to you, Justin, and there's the title of your book embedded in that decision. How should we see this particular case? Because it was outside of the schoolhouse gates. In fact, it was a Saturday afternoon. And it was online.
That's right.
And it was online on top of that.
That's right. So in that foundational opinion of Tinker, the test that Justice Fortas offered for the court is that it's permissible for school administrators to punish students if there is a reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption. So basically, if educators have a solid reason to believe that speech that is offered is going to disrupt school activities, then it's permissible to punish the students for the speech. One of the interesting things about the case is that this protest happened in 1965, to the extent that people thought about the Vietnam War at all, most Americans would have supported it. And a Des Moines high school graduate had died over in Vietnam. So you might have thought that the school administrators who sought to censor the speech were justified in doing so because they thought, well, we lost a graduate over there and his friends are still on campus. And if you all wear these black armbands, you will be dishonoring his memory and his sacrifice. The Tinker decision offers what we can understand as a heckler's veto. This is a term that First Amendment mavens use to describe the situation where a particularly sensitive listener can, if they object vociferously enough, silence otherwise legitimate speech. Heckler's vetoes are typically frowned upon in the First Amendment, but in effect, the Tinker decision offers an exception because of the sensitive area of this school. And the danger of this case, it seems to me, is if you were to say that Tinker always applies this reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption to off-campus speech, that would be incredibly burdensome and send a dangerous message to our young people and chill their expression in a significant way if they had to fear that the government was this sort of ever-present force in their lives. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the concerns that I have about a rule that would just simply say, oh, if you are a high school student, then the rule of Tinker follows you 24/7, 365 days.
Jeffrey, let me go back to you. And my understanding is that after this Snapchat, which lasted 24 hours and then it disappeared, but it was captured and sent to the coach, that there were maybe a few upset students, but no actual disruptions. Also, the school had some policies that you're not allowed to use curse words, foul language, quote, at games, fundraisers, and other events. You were not allowed to be negative about cheerleading or cheerleaders or coaches, and on and on and on. So you've got these sort of competing rules and regulations, and then you've got the Constitution.
That's absolutely right. And several of the justices at the end of the argument expressed precisely that concern, that even under Tinker, no one could think that these unattractive swear words, as Justice Breyer called them, would cause substantial disruption. He said if Levy could be punished for this, every school in the country would be doing nothing but punishing. Justice Sotomayor noted that the cheerleading coach spent a few minutes talking to the other students after the snap. You know, how could that be a substantial disruption intended to provoke disrespect, when especially because snap is supposed to disappear after 24 hours? Justice Alito said, well, why don't we just avoid this problem, send it back, say Tinker does apply in schools, without saying more about the school's power to discipline off-campus speech. But Justin makes such an important and compelling point that the heckler's veto in the 60s might have been a relatively narrow exception because it only applied in the schoolhouse itself. Mm-hmm. But now that most speech applies online, to extend it to all on online speech would be a tremendous exception to the First Amendment. And I think it's for that reason that Judge Krause, joined by Judge Bibas, wanted to draw this bright line rule and just say, if the speech is off campus, then it shouldn't apply. What was striking in the oral argument is that that line didn't seem to get a lot of traction. Even the more liberal justices like Justice Kagan was saying, well, if you apply that, then how do you discipline cyberbullying? Or how do you apply to speech that is extremely, Justice Kagan said, if the snap is school speech, then you could have all sorts of cyberbullying that could take place under this so-called geographic test, and it would hamper the school's ability to address genuine problems like cyberbullying and other behavioral issues. We couldn't put people in jail, she said, for a website created by boys at a school to rank the girls at the school on their appearance or discuss their sexual activity, but it seems like a school should be able to intervene. So I have to say, just thinking about it with you and Justin, I share Justin's concern about the heckler's veto, and my inclination then is to apply to side with Judge Krause's line and strongly distinguish between on and off campus speech. But I wonder what Justin thinks.
Sure. And Justin, if I can just frame it in another slightly different way, which is, I mean, there's speech and then there's speech. I don't know how people feel about what she posted or not. Maybe if she said, you know, damn school, damn cheer, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But how, I mean, it seems like it's important if we talk about the right to free speech to talk about what kind of speech are we talking about. And I'm sorry to say we have about a minute before our first break, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the matters that's really important here that Jeff very wisely raises is, you know, thinking about what is permissible to punish when you are off campus. And it's important to note that there are some doctrines that exist that are understood to comply with the First Amendment when it would be permissible to punish people. For example, you know, uttering a true threat against a school administrator or a fellow student, that's not protected under the First Amendment. And so it's important to contemplate, you know, sort of what exists outside. The question is whether to apply Tinker and this heckler's veto, but surely there is some speech that is permissible for schools to punish that does happen off campus, even if it's not under Tinker. Imagine, and this came up in, you know, an oral argument, a young person were to post the answers to a test, right, sort of on their Twitter account. Surely it would be permissible for the school to punish in that fashion. And so it seems to me that it would be sort of fanatical to say that it's always impermissible to punish students for speech off campus. And so it's very difficult, though, to thread that needle.
Well, we're going to continue to thread that needle with our guests, Justin Driver and Jeffrey Rosen, after this very short break. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap what we're talking about. Should schools be able to discipline students for angry, critical things they say online and outside of school? That's a question the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on this week involving a Pennsylvania school student at Pennsylvania school. We're talking about how to find that balance between a student's First Amendment rights and a school's right to police potentially disruptive, dangerous, hostile, off-campus, and online speech. You can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call at 1-888-477-9499. Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Justin Driver is a professor of law at Yale Law School, author of The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. Jeffrey, let me just go back to you. If she had, and we're talking about I'm scrambling for her name here, Brandi Levy. If she had threatened her coaches or the students who had made her made the varsity cheerleading squad, would this be a different argument?
Yes, it would be. Justin said it so well. True threats are not protected under the First Amendment. You don't have to change the rules for schools. And Justice Barrett asked the government's lawyer, Mr. Stewart, that question. She said, what about threats to the school? You know, I'm going to come in, I'm going to bring a gun to school tomorrow and open fire. And Stewart says, I still think it would be considered speech, but true threats are not constitutionally protected. So it's absolutely right, as Justin says, that there's an existing doctrine that allows schools to punish true threats or targeted bullying that qualifies as harassment and so forth, but that once you open up this huge exception that says that any off-campus speech that might cause disruption can be punished, you've really thwarted the promise of Tinker that the First Amendment doesn't stop at the schoolhouse gate. And to really put the significance of the case in the perspective that Justin rightly says, the most important case in 50 years, this is also a time when the meaning of the First Amendment is hotly contested in schools and around the country. The traditional test that speech can only be banned outside school if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence is contested by some who think that hate speech and hurt feelings should be actionable. So by allowing that kind of speech to be punished in school under the grounds that it might cause substantial disruption, you've really created a kind of shadow First Amendment as it applies to students that could have broader implications for the rest of America.
And Justin Driver, just to add to that, we've also had a year of largely remote schooling. So, you know, students have not been, for the most part, on the school campus during this pandemic year.
That's exactly right. And I think that the key concept here is about whether speech happens in a school setting or not. As you note, lots of students have been in a school setting in their living room during the pandemic. And it would not be protected speech if during the middle of class, a student were to unmute and launch into, you know, a Walt Whitman poem during algebra class. And so the court has previously recognized that the school setting sometimes happens off campus. This came up in a case called Bong Hits for Jesus.
I was going to ask you about that, actually. Yes, Bong Hits for Jesus. No, go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, so the formal name is Morse versus Frederick, but just about everybody refers to it as Bong Hits for Jesus. And that was a statement on a 14-foot-long banner that a high school senior unfurled across the street from school. And so as a formal matter, Joseph Frederick was off campus, but it was a school-sanctioned event. The Olympic torch was making its way through Juneau, Alaska. And the opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, in effect, says this was a school setting when, and therefore it was permissible for the school to punish Joseph Frederick for offering this speech that the principal here, Deborah Morse, reasonably understood to promote illicit drug use. But one of the things that is embedded in that opinion is that it had Joseph Frederick, this high school senior, sort of unfurled this same banner at downtown on a Saturday or shown it at a convenience store, it would be protected. And so it seems to me that embedded in the school's jurisprudence is this distinction between a school setting on the one hand and a non-school setting on the other. And it's clear that Brandi Levy was in a non-school setting expressing herself as many teenagers do. I mean, it's characterizing it as angry is one way, but she was frustrated. And
sure,
it seemed to me that Justice Kavanaugh sort of recognized that all sorts of high school athletes and people who participate in extracurricular activities express themselves when they are in high school all of the time in this fashion. And we want to be very careful about sending the students the message that the government's presence is, omniscient. And so that's what I'm concerned about. I also, just one last thing.
Sure.
This is exactly as Jeff suggests. This is a fraught moment in American society, and the court is polarized, often along political lines. That's a relatively new development. I hope that this is one area where liberals and conservatives could find common ground. Chief Justice Roberts has referred to himself as perhaps the biggest defender of free speech on the court. And it seems to me that sort of liberals and certainly the libertarian inflected vision of constitutional law that is ascendant in some right-leaning circles should be able to say the government is not an all-powerful force. We need to protect students from this incredibly aggressive action taken by school administrators. From my own vantage point, the idea that this sort of very common speech would create a substantial disruption, even on the cheerleading team, is an absurd possibility. So I hope that the court will conclude that as well.
Let me pick up on a couple of things, Jeffrey Rosen. I'll put them to you. I'm quoting here from Brandy Levy. She said, "I posted it on my Snapchat, so I was expecting everyone to see it, but I didn't think I was going to get in trouble because it was only to my friends that had seen it, and I didn't think I was going to get in trouble because I didn't specifically target anyone or anything." I mean, rolling back the clock 4 years. I mean, the administrators, it seems, could have sat down with her or the coaches and said, "Look, Brandy, you know, we really don't like this. Please don't do this." And, you know, rather than suspending her from cheerleading. I know you're not an expert on cheerleading suspensions, but it just feels like such an overreaction at the very beginning.
Absolutely. And several of the justices had precisely that reaction. Justice Barrett said there are soft reactions, like you could just talk to her rather than punishing her this extremely. Justice Kavanaugh, who of course coaches basketball in his spare time, agreed that the suspension seems like a bit of an overreaction. And he reminded listeners that Michael Jordan told the story of being cut from a varsity basketball team when he got into the Hall of Fame. She was simply blowing off steam, as many teenagers do. So, now, I very much share Justin's hope that libertarian conservatives and civil libertarian liberals could converge in this case mm-hmm. on a speech protective rule. And speech in general is an area where the Roberts Court has come up with unanimous or nearly so opinions. This is also a time when, to many people's surprise, the Roberts Court has avoided 6-3 or 5-4 decisions in a whole bunch of recent cases, including, of course, most significantly this week in the NCAA basketball yeah. case and the Affordable Care Act and religious freedom. So you'd hope that this would be a case for that kind of bipartisan comedy. I fear, though, from the oral argument that the justices may converge, but it won't be on a libertarian rule. It'll be just on a narrow rule, basically punting and sending the case back to the lower court saying the Tinker case does apply and you guys figure it out, but we don't think there was a substantial disruption here, so we don't need to create a bright line between on and off campus. That would be basically just push down the road this mm-hmm. central question that we're talking about how to protect free speech online. And it would mean that the litigation would continue.
Well, it's interesting, Justin, you've got, as I understand it, you've got the ACLU and libertarians on one side, and then you had the American Federation of Teachers, the National School Boards Association, and other educational organizations on the other side. Does that tell us something?
Yeah, it's a very interesting case in the sense that lots of amicus briefs were filed, not just by the ACLU, who's representing Brandy Levy, but the Rutherford Institute, Cato, Pacific Legal Foundation. These are, right of center organizations that came to Brandy Levy's defense, and the Christian Legal Society for that matter as well. And I do think that there's a broad understanding that students ought to be able to express themselves, and religious folks are often concerned about young people being able to express themselves freely about matters involving, sexual orientation or abortion, and school administrators in effect saying, "Oh, that's too hot of a topic. We shouldn't have that here." And that's exactly what Tinker was meant to protect. One of the marvelous things about that opinion by Justice Fortas is that he says, ours is a relatively open, often disputatious society, and one of the sort of things that makes America a special place is that we protect the clamor and the exchange of ideas. That's one of the things that makes our democracy vital. And so I do hope that, as I say, this coalition of left of center organizations and right of center organizations can carry the day, and that we will have a lopsided opinion. I do also share Jeff's concern that this might lead to a narrow opinion where they just say, with Judge Ambrose, that the speech in question here did not create a reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption. And so this speech is protected, but it saves many of the really difficult questions for another day and does not offer the guidance to school administrators and even to lower court judges that they so desperately need in this area.
And that's Justin Driver, who joins us along with Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, expected to rule in the next couple of days, involving a Pennsylvania high school student named Brandy Levy and her F-bomb-filled rant on Snapchat about not making it to the varsity cheerleading team. She was suspended from the JV team. She and her family sued the school district. It made it through the lower courts and now before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're talking about some of the constitutional and important issues at stake, including students' First Amendment rights, a school's authority to police off-campus and online speech. And again, you can join us. I'll read some comments here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. A comment from Marita: we just spent a year of virtual school, and the concept of off-campus seems pretty fluid at this point. Comment from Paul: this is a teachable moment for a generation of people who live on social media. Instead of punishment, how about you sit the student down and talk about how this is inappropriate? A tweet from Living Online Lab: thank you for this fascinating discussion. What are the differences between public and private schools when it comes to concerns of free speech? Jeffrey, can I toss that to you? Do we know the answer to that?
We do. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say Mark Zuckerberg shall make no law, or a private school like Yale Law School, for example, shall make no law. So in theory, private schools are not bound by the First Amendment and are free to punish speech more severely than the First Amendment would require. In practice, there's some private schools have chosen to bind themselves by the First Amendment. Harvard University, for example, as a matter of policy, says they'll broadly respect First Amendment guidelines. So the court's decision will have big implications for public and private schools, but technically private schools are not bound by the First Amendment.
Justin Driver, do high school students have the same constitutional rights and protections as adults?
That's a very good question. And no is the answer to the question as a result of Tinker. But it's important to note that one must be context specific. And if a 16-year-old is in the public park rather than the public school, they enjoy rights that are typically coextensive with the rights of adults. There are some exceptions to that. There's something called a variable obscenity statute, which makes it permissible to prevent young people from buying pornography. But typically, young people have, again, very robust free speech rights when they are in the non-school setting. And that seems to me to be quite appropriate. The Supreme Court entertained a case involving violent video games that sought to prevent young people from purchasing violent video games, and the Supreme Court invalidated that statute and noted that young people are exposed to violence in a variety of different settings, including even sort of Grimm's fairy tales and things of that nature. So the dominant trend is to give people, young people, quite expansive protections. And so in many respects, we should think about not so much young people versus old people, but rather whether students are, you know, in school, or they are young people outside of school who have these very broad rights.
Jeffrey, did the word parents ever come up in any of the arguments before the justices, or even as it made its way to the high court?
I'll do a word search as we're talking from the argument transcript.
I was just thinking, here we are talking about, you know, schools and students, and we have these parents that also exist.
They do. And I think there was a sense that the coaches could have acted more like parents in counseling the kids rather than punishing them like that. Here we go. This is the magic of the Google. Let's start with this case. Can you punish the student for cursing at home? Ms. Blatt, absolutely. Justice Sotomayor, or at her parents' home? And then it's not fair to the parents of the other kids to have the school fumbling around. And that's the basic idea. Also, Justice Sotomayor said, I'm told by my law clerks among certain populations of how much you curse is a badge of honor. That would surprise many parents. So this is my quick search. But you're right that this is a time that we're asking students and coaches to perform the role of parents. And as Justin says, and as your question suggested, Marty, now that everything is school, and all, my kids and all of us who have had kids learning at home know how dramatically they felt the erasure of the boundary between home and school during this COVID year, teachers are being asked to play this role of parents, and that's why where we draw the free speech lines is so important.
Yeah, and Justin, we're almost up at a break here. Any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, the key concept here is, you know, in loco parentis, and that was the dominant view for a long period of time, that in effect, when parents send their children to school, they are delegating parental authority and educators occupy the position of the parents. That view, however, has really atrophied over time, happily, from my own perspective. And there's an understanding that the educators are not parents and that they can violate the freedom of speech or the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. And so there's a growing conception over the last, you know, five decades or so that students retain constitutional rights when they are in the school. Typically, they are watered down or, you know, diluted constitutional rights, but they are not non-existent. And so I hope that, again, the Supreme Court of the United States will offer some protection to students when they are in non-school settings. That's what we're really talking about here. Yeah, so yes, please.
Fair enough. They're playing my music, so I have to end this conversation. But we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just quickly recap what we're talking about. Should schools, public schools, be able to discipline students for angry, critical things they say online and outside of the school setting? It's a case that was just argued a couple of months ago before the U.S. Supreme Court. We're discussing with our guests some of the arguments before the Supreme Court about students' rights to free speech and a school's authority to police off-campus and online speech considered dangerous and disruptive. Again, the court is expected to rule in the next couple of days. And our guests are Yale Law Professor Justin Driver, author of The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind, and Jeffrey Rosen, also a lawyer, and he is the CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia. And again, we want to hear from you, where you stand on this particular issue. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jeffrey, let me go back to something that Brandy Levy said. I believe she was either interviewed on PBS or NPR. I feel that it's important that because I think the school shouldn't be able to punish students for what they say off campus as long as it's not like harassing, threatening, and bullying. I just want to make sure our listeners understand the distinction between doing F-bombs aimed at just, you know, letting off steam on a Saturday afternoon, and the more probably common and worrisome threats that can happen online and off campus that can directly affect students. Help us understand sort of how that works and what the law says and the Constitution says about that.
Absolutely. Well, the best place to look is the National Constitution Center's Interactive Constitution. And there's a great explainer on the First Amendment written by Eugene Volokh and Jeff Stone, two of the greatest First Amendment scholars, liberal and conservative. And they note that generally, under the First Amendment, even offensive speech like curse words are protected because the test is speech can only be banned if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. That's an extremely high bar. And we remember from President Trump's second impeachment trial, it wasn't people were disagreeing about whether even go march on the Capitol met that test. But there are a series of exceptions that they note in their explainer on the First Amendment. And those include things like not only defamation and libel and so-called fighting words, but true threats, laws that are directed at particular individuals and credibly threaten lawless actions, as well as unprotected obscenity. So she, Brandy, was expressing very eloquently a citizen's desire to generally have the ability to let off steam, even in an offensive way, as long as the speech was otherwise protected under the First Amendment. And I couldn't have said it better.
Well, let me put it back to you, Justin. If we're talking about, let's say, bullying and the kinds of pernicious threats that can happen, again, off campus and online, how do we make sure that we can protect the kind of speech that Jeffrey was just talking about, but make sure that students are not harmed?
Yeah, I think that school administrators are in a difficult position here. Indeed, they are, in some instances, in effect, required to monitor these sorts of bullying statements. Bullying is not a new phenomenon with respect to the internet, but the internet does make adults able to sort of access this content. And so I do think that the anti-bullying laws that exist can be squared with the First Amendment. And the question here is whether to impose the incredibly restrictive standard of Tinker on students when they are in non-school settings. There's one other item that I want to address, which is about the nature of extracurricular activities. I suspect that some of your listeners are thinking, well, this wasn't a suspension from school. All that happened is she was told that she couldn't be on the junior varsity cheerleading team for a year. And sort of shouldn't we hold our athletes to, you know, higher standards? I think that's not the right way to view this. We've seen instances of overzealous school administrators in other extracurricular settings punish students. There's a Second Circuit case from here in Connecticut where a student expressed views that were critical of school administrators off campus. She did so online. She was an elected member of the student council, and she referred to the school administrators as douchebags, and she encouraged her fellow students and their parents to contact the school administrators. And for that exchange, she was prohibited from running for re-election to the student council in her senior year. And when you step back and think about it for a moment, this is a young person who is encouraging her fellow citizens to contact the government in the form of the public school, and doing so in a way that's perhaps suboptimal, but certainly not sort of intimidating or bullying anybody. And nevertheless, the Second Circuit upheld this suspension. And so this underscores the way that young people care tremendously about extracurricular activities, and young people are often finding their voices by speaking out against school administrators. And that is something that if they don't do so in a violent way or an intimidating way or a bullying way, should be protected.
Jeffrey, how much of this is about the use of F-bombs or, as Justin said, douchebags? I mean, this is about words, words that sort of rankle adults.
Well, it certainly is. And people are very concerned about words in school these days. Any of us who are parents and any of us who are students know that the fear of giving offense is so great that people, teachers as well as students, are suffering consequences for their words all the time. And there's almost a disconnect between the extraordinarily speech-protective tests of the First Amendment that we've been talking about. Speech can only be banned if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. And the reality that we all see on Twitter and in classrooms every day, where people are being disciplined and suffering consequences for far less. So that's why this case is so tremendously important. It's why Justin is so right to note that the justices may focus on special contexts, like the fact that it was an extracurricular activity, and several of them said, well, maybe that's a narrow way to say it. You can not allow someone to compete on the squad, but perhaps not discipline the speech in school. But all of that, and I agree with Justin in every respect, would avoid this central question. Just because words are so important, because students can urge their fellow students to exercise their political rights, to dissent, to challenge school authorities, let's not drive a big hole through the First Amendment and allow students to be punished for their words in ways that adults couldn't be.
And this might be a little off topic, Justin Driver, but are we talking, is it sort of like the First Amendment colliding with cancel culture? Is that also an issue?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You referenced earlier some of the code of conduct, sort of agreements that Brandy Levy entered into in order to be a cheerleader. And it's important to note that these sorts of codes of conduct, it can in no way supersede the First Amendment. And I would fear school administrators offering these sorts of, pledges of good citizenship, not just to extracurricular athletes and people who participate in extracurricular activities, but instead just students. And, if you bring some sort of, dishonor to our public school, we reserve the right to punish you. And certainly people who would be thinking about cancellation culture would be, concerned about this phenomenon. So there is a scenario where even if the Supreme Court of the United States hands down a rule that says extracurricular activities are one thing, surely there are overzealous school administrators who are going to take that principle and extend it beyond the extracurricular setting and say, well, this sort of, disruption and confusion happens all of the time. So why don't we just have all of our students sign these sorts of agreements that they will not swear and things of that nature? And I hope that the courts would invalidate those measures, given the fact that there are compulsory education laws, which for many people means going to the local public school.
Jeffrey, I've mentioned this several times that we're expecting the Supreme Court to rule in the next couple of days. I think Thursday is when they make their final rulings. Do they generally save the best for last? And by that, I mean, I guess the most consequential for last?
Not the most consequential, but the most divisive. They generally issue opinions when they're ready. So if everyone can agree, then the opinion comes out. Now, we've seen a bunch of very hotly contested opinions come out just this week, the Affordable Care Act and so forth, and they were able to find unexpected agreements. I think, based on our discussion, Justin and I don't expect a 5-4 or 6-3 case here. It's not a conventional ideological division. But the fact that it hasn't come out yet suggests that they're still struggling to figure out the right answer.
Do you feel the same way, Justin?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about this is that it was argued very late in the term. It was argued in late April, and the court tries to get rid of its business by the end of June. Justices go on summer break just right around when school children are released from school. And so it's possible that the late argument date is responsible for the fact that we have not seen the opinion be handed down yet. And I would also say that the fact that the case was argued so late in the term, roughly 2 months before the end of the term, might militate in favor of a very narrow opinion along the lines that Jeff suggested earlier and that Judge Ambrose offered. You heard some of this in oral argument where Justice Breyer, my old boss, said, he sort of detested the idea of writing a treatise in this area. And Justice Kavanaugh echoed that concern, which means in this context, I don't want to write some very long opinion that anticipates every sort of eventuality that may arise. Instead, we just want to decide effectively this case and, save for another day some of the more intricate questions.
Just let me quote something from your book. You wrote, no other arena of constitutional decision-making, not churches, not hotels, not hospitals, not restaurants, not police stations, not military bases, not automobiles, not even homes, comes close to matching the cultural import of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence governing public schools. That's a big, powerful sentence. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. The cases involving schools get everyday Americans' blood boiling in a way that other cases simply do not. Think about Brown versus Board of Education and racial segregation in the 1950s. Think about teacher-led prayer and that being prohibited in the 1960s. These cases were incredibly hot button, and everyday Americans really do care about them in an intense way. You could think about in the 1980s, there was an important decision involving a state law that sought to prohibit unauthorized immigrants from attending a public school. So these cases really are quite combustible, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out why. There are more than 50 million students in public schools on any given day, and it takes millions of adults to run those schools in an effective way. And so that means that on any given school day, roughly 1/6 of the American population is in school, and it's the first sustained exposure that many people have to a governmental authority. And so the lessons that our young people encounter in school, they take with them for the rest of their lives. And so that's why this is, in my mind, the most contested area of or contested site of constitutional decision making in our nation's history.
Jeffrey, you mentioned the fact that the court has been busy this week, and even looking back over the last couple of weeks of decisions, what do you make of the Roberts Court today?
Well, it's been an extraordinary term. I mean, many predicted that with the addition of Justice Barrett, it would be a whole bunch of 6-3 conservative decisions. And just we've seen case after case, the Affordable Care Act case, 7-2, the Fulton Religious Freedom case from Philadelphia, 9-0, the Athletics case, 9-0, where the Roberts Court has fulfilled Chief Justice Roberts' hope of narrow, nearly unanimous bipartisan opinions that avoid sweeping constitutional rulings. There have been just a few exceptions to that. Earlier this term, we had the 5-4 case about COVID coming out of New York, about COVID restrictions and religious worship services. But by and large, this has been the term that's produced more unexpected coalitions in significant and divisive cases than ever before. Now, this may not last. Next term, we have huge Second Amendment and abortion cases on the docket. But at least temporarily, this was a vision of what a bipartisan court could look like.
And from your perspective, Justin, how do you see the Roberts Court today?
You know, I think that Jeff's point is very well taken. Jeff is too modest to say it, but he wrote a very important article when Chief Justice Roberts began his tenure, identifying what scholars might refer to as judicial minimalism. Chief Justice Roberts has said when he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit, if it's not necessary to decide more, it is necessary not to decide more. That really is, his sort of ethos and something that he has tried to impose in the court. Now, it doesn't apply all of the time, but Jeff's article remains quite relevant. He wrote it something like 16 years today, and it's one of the things that makes him sort of a national treasure in terms of his ability to communicate legal concepts to the public. So I say amen to Jeff.
Well, I'm sure he is blushing. We're here on the radio together.
Thank you, Justin.
Justin Driver, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here with you.
Well, thanks so much. And he's a professor of law at Yale Law School and author of The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. And Jeffrey Rosen, thank you, as always, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for convening me and Justin. Such a pleasure to talk to him and to you.
Well, thanks so much. And again, he's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia, across the street from WHYY. He's also a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.